It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up, America, and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike puts on a coast-to-coast mingled fun and facts party. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in defense stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 defense bond plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now right up a Lucky Strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Paterman. Mr. Paterman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please continues on its usual spontaneous and unrehearsed way. Tonight, our two anchor men, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran, are on deck, together with our two guests, the eminent Broadway maestro, Russell Krauss, co-author of Life with Father, and second, the well-known sports expert and writer, Mr. Paul Gallico, whose most recent book is The Snow Goose. Now, we'll start with a question from Audrey Valentine of Richmond, California. It's about ruined marriages. Gentlemen, ruined marriages. In what play was a marriage ruined for the following reason? There are going to be four of these. Get three out of four. In what play was a marriage ruined by the wife's nagging? Just one play, gentlemen, will do. By the wife's nagging. Mr.
Would that be Craig's wife?
Craig's wife, yes. By who?
Lord Kelly.
By
George Kelly.
George Kelly, yes. A comedy of some years ago. In what play was a marriage ruined by the husband's unreasoning jealousy? Mr. Kieran.
Othello by W. Shakespeare.
Yes, correct. Miss Crowley?
And 5,286 other plays.
That's not quite as good, though. In what one was the marriage ruined because the wife was having a good time in Europe? You see, that must have been some time ago. And refused to go home, Mr. Adams.
Might be Dodsworth.
Dodsworth by Sinclair Lewis. Who did the dramatization, Mr. Adams? Do you remember?
Sidney Howard.
Sidney Howard and Sinclair Lewis working together?
I think Sidney Howard was helped a little by Mr. Lewis, yes.
Good enough. Now, in what play was a marriage ruined because the husband crushed his wife's individuality? The husband crushed his wife's individuality. Figure that one out. Any ideas? We're safe with three out of four, but I'd like to get this four out of four if I can. Mr. Adams.
Well, there was a play, Main Street.
I don't think that...
It was a play.
Yes, it was a play, but I don't think that would necessarily be appropriate. Mr. Krauss.
Taming of the Shrew?
No, I think Ibsen's Doll's House is the one I'm after. Ibsen's Doll's House. That gives us three out of four. Now, how about this one? From Ollie Matthews of Detroit. I want you to give me three of the four times in the past when the heavyweight title changed hands because the winner outpointed the champ. The winner outpointed the champ. Three of the four times. This may not be so easy. Mr. Gallico, you start us off.
Joe Lewis outpointed Braddock, I believe.
No, that wouldn't be it. Mr. Krauss?
Braddock outpointed Max Baer.
Yes, that would be one. 35, in 15-round bout. Now, Mr. Kieran, can you go on to the second
one? Well, Tony outpointed Dempsey.
Yes.
And
Mr. Gallagher?
Schmeling, Sharkey outpointed Schmeling.
That's right. That gives us three. Now, there's one more, and this one goes back a long way. Any ideas?
Since the glove fights?
Yes, 19-6. That would be in glove fights. No bare knuckles in those days, were there?
Jim Corbett must have been involved in that one.
No,
Mr. Gallico, he wasn't.
Heavyweight? Jeffries?
Yes, this is all heavyweight bouts.
1906?
Yes, Mr. Carey. Remember?
Well, Jeffries was champion, and Jack Johnson came, and Noah Brusso came in there, otherwise known as Tommy Burns.
That's the one.
Well, that was he wasn't really a recognized champion at that time.
He's recognized on my card here. It says he became heavyweight champion at Los Angeles by winning a 20-round decision from Marvin Hart.
If Karen doesn't recognize him, your card's not.
I guess you're right, Mr. Gallagher.
Well, he was recognized after that, but I don't think that... I'm not sure that that was a recognized type of fight.
We'll recognize him.
Well, fighters are hard to recognize after a fight anyway, aren't they?
How about this one from Mrs. E.H. Shaw of Seattle? Now, this is a musical question.
And as Mr. Levant is not on this evening, it's probably a very simple musical question. Now, in each of these musical selections that you're going to hear, somebody is supposed to be taking a walk. Where is he or she taking the walk? Listen to the selections as they're played. Get 3 out of 4. Let's have the first. Mr. Gallagher.
Fifth Avenue.
Good enough. What is the musical selection?
The Easter Parade.
Very good. What's it from?
Jubilee.
No.
Thousand's Cheer.
That's Thousand's Cheer, Mr. Krause reminds us. Clifton Webb. Irving Berlin and Clifton Webb is the...
And Moss Hart.
Very good. Now, how about the next? That's a very familiar selection. Gallagher nods his head and says it's familiar. Just not familiar enough, perhaps. Any ideas? How about a guess? Mr. Adams, care to guess?
Sounds like Gilbert and Sullivan.
No. Is it? It isn't Gilbert and Sullivan. No, it's Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, a part of it. And
Walking in the Woods.
Attaboy, in the country, Mr. Adams, in the country. I count that wrong, yes. Let's have the third. Adams?
The walk was along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air.
Yes, that's right. It's the... And the song is what?
The Man That Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo.
That's a perfect response, Mr. Adams. Thank you. I suppose everybody listening got that. How about the next one? Mr. Gallagher.
He must have been walking on the boulevard in Paris. That's, An American in Paris.
That's exactly right, Mr. Gallico. Very good. That is not so easy, I think. And the composer, of course, is...
Gershwin.
George Gershwin. George Quite Gershwin. Right. That gives us 3 out of 4. Here's one from Mrs. C.S. Radford of Pine Beach, New Jersey. Now, the following quotations, I'm going to give you 3 of them, consist of questions, and each is followed by an answer. And you're to give the answers, something new on this program. Let's have the answer to the first. What's that so black... Against the sun. What's that so black against the sun? I have 2 hands. Mr. Adams?
It's Danny fighting hard for life.
Very good, Mr. Adams. That's right. What's
the color sergeant said.
That's right. Very good. What's it from?
Danny Deaver.
Danny Deaver by whom?
R. Kipling.
Okay.
J.R. Kipling.
J.R. Kipling. What was his first name?
Joseph.
Does everybody know that, Mr. Adams?
No, I just know.
They do now. And now the second question. Give me the answer. Old Father, I hear the church bells ring. Oh, say, what may it be? What's the answer to that question, Mr. Curran?
Well, the answer, I'm not sure the following lines is that you're just as safe on the sea as...
Oh, no.
Isn't it? Adams?
That's from the regular
you're that God is on the waters, God is on the land as well as on the sea.
No, that's from We Were Crowded in the Cabin.
Whenever you boys get through, I'll be glad to come
I
back.
I still think there's something that, about God being on the sea as well as on the land.
That may be part of the poem, but it's not the answer to this particular question. Now, the poem involved, Mr. Adams, is what?
The Wreck of the Hesperus.
That's correct, yes. And the answer to, O Father, I hear the church bells ring, O say, what may it be, is, 'Tis a fog bell on a rock-bound coast, and he steered for the open sea. Does any of you remember that now? Should come back to you from the third grade.
On the Reef of Norman's Woe.
Well, that gets in the poem sooner or later. That gives us 1 wrong. Now we have to get the next right. Where are you going and what do you wish? Mr. Adams.
We are going to fish for the herring fish.
That's correct. That's correct.
It grows in the Zuider Sea.
Very good. What's the
term? Nets of silver and gold have we. Winkin, and Nod.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
What a memory.
And that, of course, gives us the title of the poem. Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod by Mr. Adams?
Eugene Field.
By Eugene Field. That's perfect. How about this one from Bernhard A. Friedman of Brooklyn, New York? This is a news events question. Get 2 out of 3. I'm going to give you some clues. What a recent news event is brought to mind by them? The first clue is 12-man board. That's all I'll give you as a help. 12-man board. Does that bring anything to mind?
Appointed day before yesterday.
Thrown out whatever it is.
No, I think they still have it, Mr. Gallico. It's within the last week, you see. Mr. Adams,
It's a business administration board.
Mr. Gallagher, can you help Mr. Adams out?
I think it's the new strike mediation board, which contains four for labor, four for the people, and four for government.
Industry.
Industry.
Yes, that's exactly right, Mr. Gallico. The 12-man War Labor Board, recently appointed by the President. Any of you remember the name of the chairman of it?
Mr. Nelson.
No.
Davis. William Davis.
William Davis, yes. You're thinking of another appointment, Mr. Adams. How about this as a clue? Swaps Uncle. Swaps, S-W-A-P-S, meaning to exchange, Mr. Krause.
Joe Lewis swapped Uncle Mike Jacobs for Uncle Sam United States.
Very good. Yes, that's right. That was pretty quick, Mr. Curio.
Very
Mr.
good.
Krause, wasn't it? Oh, very good.
Less than I expected.
11 silenced. 11 silenced. Mr. Krause again.
11 Japanese batteries in the Philippine Islands were silenced by American guns.
Good.
That's hooray, hooray, right. Hooray.
Very good. And that was very good, Mr. Krause, and the rest of you might read your papers from time to time.
Mr. Kieran? They can read mine.
Yes, they might. Mr. Kieran, do you do nothing but write for the papers? Don't you read them anymore? Look at Mr. Krause, knowing all these things right
off the bat. I love to look at them.
Here's one from John A. Anderson of Chicago. Now listen closely. In a closet are hanging the following. A linen suit, a cotton dress, an alpaca jacket, and a skunk coat. Linen suit, cotton dress, alpaca jacket, and a skunk coat. Now, none of them has been treated chemically. Which of them might conceivably be moth-eaten, supposing that they weren't subjected to any chemical treatment to prevent moths in any case? Which of them might be moth-eaten? Linen suit, cotton dress, an alpaca jacket, and a skunk coat. I have never seen a more phased look on four faces in my life. Mr. Gallico?
Well,
take a
I
chance?
Know, we always keep mothballs in my wife's fur coats.
That would mean what to
that
your actual brain?
Skunk coat.
Right. It would be moth-eaten or would not be moth-eaten?
Might be moth-eaten.
Might be moth-eaten.
A moth that cared for skunk at that
That point. Is right. If there were a skunk-loving moth in the house, it would go for the skunk coat. Now we have a linen suit, a cotton dress, and now pack a jacket to worry about. Mr. Gallico, you're doing very well so far. Care to guess? Mr. Kieran?
Well, I'll guess if the moth is correct in the first place, then that the alpaca is also vulnerable because that is also an animal product.
Yes. From what animal is the alpaca?
From the alpaca, which is one of the four relatives of the camel of the camel tribe in South America.
The others being second cousins. What are these other relatives?
The others are the alpaca, the llama, the guanaco, and...
that white thing.
There's another one.
That's a muppet.
Vicuña.
The vicuña. Did you know any of that, Mr. Adams?
Never heard of
him. Never heard of him.
I let them all sin. I like them.
Well, now that gives us an alpaca jacket and a skunk coat as apparently something that moths would like. Now, how about the linen suit and the cotton dress? Let's clean this up. Mr. Kieran.
I think probably not. Those
what?
Are vegetable products.
Yes, and the moths don't care for vegetable products for some reason or other.
My moths do.
Well, you may have vegetarian moths. I don't know. Now, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out no $50 defense bonds and no sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, Mr. Krause says that if he were writing a dictionary for smokers, the first and last word would be the same.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the ideal first and last word in every cigarette smoker's vocabulary should be the word tobacco. For you smokers know, if you stop to think of it, that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And the better the tobacco, the better the cigarette. That's why we consistently pay the price at auctions all over the South to get the milder, better-tasting tobacco for Lucky's. For example, at auctions in Clarkton, North Carolina this season, the American Tobacco Company paid 33% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 33% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. So it goes at market after market, and the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. The result is Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Mr. Fadiman, isn't that something for all smokers to act on when buying cigarettes?
Indeed it is, Mr. Krause, and you told us why in exactly 53 seconds. Now, how about this one, gentlemen, from Harold T. Freerwood of Dayton, Ohio. Get 2 out of 3. What game is played with the top of the net at the following heights from the playing area? If it's 5 feet from the playing area, what game are we playing? Top of the net's 5 feet from the playing area. Mr. Adams.
I think that might be badminton.
It is badminton. Mr. Kieran, would that... there wouldn't be any alternative to that. Badminton is right. Now, how about 8 feet? Top of the net's 8 feet from the playing area. What game are we playing? Mr. Kieran?
I think, isn't that the punch ball?
Is that the same as volleyball?
Yes.
Well, then that's volleyball.
Thank you, sir.
How about it, Mr. Gallico?
Well, I was just jumping out of a burning building.
or any or high jumping if it's just 8 feet above the surface of the ground. How about 3 feet? And that's 3 feet. Mr. Gallico?
That should be tennis.
Mr. Adams, is that right?
That's tennis at the center.
Is there a difference?
There's a difference. Three and a half at the sides.
You see, Mr. Gallico, you have to be very careful what you say on this program. Very careful. 3 feet, of course, is right with the emendation that Mr. Adams, the precisionist, gives us.
I'd better stay away from these sports questions.
Here's one from R. Pine of Webster Grove, Missouri. What characters in books passed through these places on their travels? I suppose we get 2 out of 3 on this. Here's the first itinerary. Wheatsylvania, New York, St. Hubert, Vermont. Who, in a book, passed through all those 4 places? Wheatsylvania, New York, St. Hubert, and Vermont. Mr. Adams? What was that hand you had up? Just the nervous gesture.
Just figuring the itinerary like that.
Making a map in the air. Mr. Krause? No ideas, gentlemen. It's Arrowsmith, the Sinclair Lewis's hero in the book of that name. Had his early career in Wheatsylvania, North Dakota, came to New York, then went down to St. Hubert, which is in the East West Indies, and then ended in Vermont. Wheatsylvania, I suppose, is an imaginary town. Shall we call that wrong? I guess so. How about this? Dresden, Smolensk, Moscow, Smolensk, Berezina. Mr. Kieran.
Napoleon.
And in what book would you find him doing, going through those places?
Well, in any book on Napoleon and his campaign to Moscow and return.
What famous book, Mr. Gallico?
Caulaincourt's Memoirs.
And Caulaincourt's Memoirs, very good. And that's a rather unfamiliar one. War and Peace by Tolstoy, which is perhaps the most famous account of the Napoleonic campaign. How about this? Mexico, Colombia, Bolivia, Argentina. What character in a book passed through those places?
Sumner Wells.
Not yet. He's gone. I think Mr. Wells has gone straight to Rio and doing a good job there, too. But hasn't passed through all these places in his travels. Mexico, Colombia, Bolivia, Argentina. You don't know, apparently. It's a friend of ours who's been on this program from time to time. Mr. Krause?
John Gunther.
Yes, I won't give you any credit for it. John Gunther in his book, Inside Latin America. Well, that will lose a $50 defense bond going to Mr. Pine plus a set of the Britannica. And how about this from H.S. Connolly of Pittsburgh? This, again, is a musical question, gentlemen. Get 2 out of 3. Why would you probably not hear any of these classics in Germany this winter? If you happen to be there, which you wouldn't be in any case. Listen to them. They're going to be 3. Here's the first. Mr. Adams.
I think that's the Mendelssohn Concerto.
Yes, it is, Mr. Adams. And why wouldn't that be heard in German?
Because Mendelssohn wrote it.
Because Mendelssohn wrote it, and he is what the Germans call a non-Aryan. By the way, I was reading in a book the other day that the Germans have declared the Sioux Indians to be Aryans. I don't know why they should want to do that. They must be running very short.
It'll be a terrible shock to the Sioux Indians.
Yes, it will be. It's a great insult to the Sioux Indians. Is it true, Mr. Kieran, that the Japanese are Aryans, according to the German point of view? Honorary Aryans?
I really do not keep up with the German point of view.
Mr. Kieran, they're for Hero Hitler now, don't they?
Maybe so. Now, how about this next musical selection, which would not be played in Germany this winter? Why? Let's have it. Any ideas, gentlemen? Mr. Gallico, you seem to be very alert there, comparatively.
I will know the answer about 10 o'clock tonight.
Call us up. Gentlemen, that's something from Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Why would that not be played in Germany? I'll give you one guess.
Because Tchaikovsky's a non-German.
Tchaikovsky is a non-German.
Happens to be a Russian.
He's a Russian, yes. He's a Russian, and they prefer not to be reminded of the Russians any more than they can help at the moment. Well, that gives us one wrong. Now, how about the next? Mr. Krause had a hand up in one.
Well, one, because it's American jazz, and two, because it's too good for them.
Yes, both reasons are correct. Chattanooga Choo Choo would not be played. It's American jazz, which is taboo in Germany. And American jazz is very happy about it, I'm sure. Here's one from S.D. Silverberg of Elmhurst, New York. Get 2 out of 3. First, can you name for us a country that's at war with the United States and England, but not with Russia? Mr. Akira.
Japan.
Japan is right. There are two others that there are in that condition, Manchukuo and Bulgaria. But I don't think they'd be very easy to remember. Now, how about this one? A country that's at war with Russia and England, but not with the United States. It's at war with Russia and England. Mr. Krause?
Finland.
Finland is right. That, I think, would be the only answer. Now, how about this? Suppose you give me 4 countries of Europe that are neither at war with nor occupied by Germany. There are more than 4, but I'd like to get 4. Mr. Gallico?
Switzerland.
Switzerland is right.
Sweden?
Sweden is right, Mr. Gallico. You can rest on your laurels if you wish.
I'd like to.
Give him a laurel, Mr. Krause, and have him rest on it for a minute, will you? Mr. Kieran?
Spain, Portugal, and Ireland.
Yes, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, and that gives us 5. 2 more are Turkey and Albania. Turkey and Albania. There are 7.
Albania was taken over by Italy.
Yes, but it's not occupied by Germany. Unless you think that that's about
have
the same
thing. Have you looked
lately? You may be right at that, Mr. Kieran. Here's one from Marilyn Mayer of Chicago. It's about secretaries. Whom do these secretaries serve? Get 2 out of 3. Grace Tully is secretary to whom? Grace Tully, T-U-L-L-Y. I think Miss Tully's been publicized more or less recently. Any ideas, gentlemen? She is secretary to Franklin D. Roosevelt. You know who Franklin D. Roosevelt is, at least, don't you, gentlemen? How about this one? Martha Heppelthwaite. Martha Heppelthwaite. Mr. Krause.
Secretary to Frank Sullivan, the Saratoga Sage.
Yes. That is an imaginary lady, I presume.
She hangs from the chandeliers and does various things of that sort.
In the book?
Yes.
Yes. All right. How about this one? Margaret Cutler, secretary to whom? Margaret Cutler. Mr. Krause, you might be expected to know that, perhaps. More or less up one of your many alleys. Sheridan Whiteside, who is the hero, if you want to call him that, of The Man Who Came to Dinner. His secretary is Margaret Cutler. Remember that now?
Well, that's Kaufman and Hart's alley.
Yes, but don't you see your colleagues' plays at all?
Oh, yes. But I don't turn around their alley.
That sends a $50 defense bond to Miss Mayer and a set of the Britannica and sends us on to this question from Raymond Knox of Philadelphia. I think this is a rather interesting one. This is a 3 out of 4 question. Can you name the news commentator from this characteristic phrase that he uses to either an opening or closing his broadcast? The first phrase is very characteristic. Good evening. Mr. Gallico.
Raymond Graham Swing.
Raymond Graham Swing, yes. It's
oh,
curious.
Good evening.
Yes. How do you say it?
Good evening.
Give us 15 minutes of this sort of thing. That's right. Now, how about...
It's gloomy.
It's a little gloomy. Dignified, perhaps, is a better word. How about, so long until tomorrow? I bet Mr. Gallagher can give it to us in the dialect. So long until tomorrow. Who says that? Obviously, in closing his broadcast, Mr. Kitt.
I think that's Lowell Thomas.
Lowell Thomas is right. Yes, very good. So long until tomorrow. Now, how about, and that's the news at this moment, Mr. Adams.
That's Elmer Davis.
That's Elmer Davis.
And very good, too.
Very good, too. And finally, and that's all the news from Washington at this time. Who says that? Mr. Krause.
Earl Godwin.
Earl Godwin, yes.
NBC.
NBC's Washington correspondent. You better say that's okay, too, Mr. Krause, all right?
I saw that NBC on there.
Very good. How about this one from Lois McCarthy of Los Angeles? Get 2 out of 3. Name the victims of each of these murderers in literature. George Milton. He's the murderer. Who's the victim? George Milton. I bet if I just said George, you'd get it. Mr. Adams.
That would be in Steinbeck's book.
Yes, you see, all I do is give you half of it, half of the name. You can get it, give you the whole name, can't get it. What book, Mr. Adams?
Of Mice and Men.
Yes, and the victim's name you wouldn't remember, unless I gave you the name.
Lenny.
Say, that's good. What's his last name, Mr. Adams? Don't care for last names.
I don't know.
Snobbish. Lenny Small. Lenny Small. How about Tuska? Whom does Tuska kill? Mr. Kieran?
She kills Scarpia.
She kills Scarpia.
Chief of police, isn't he, or something?
I think so. Is that right, Mr. Gallico? You had your hand up.
That's correct.
Scarpia is right.
Baron Scarpia, as long as we're giving him his full title.
All right, Baron Scarpia, let it be. Now, how about Porgy? Porgy kills whom? Porgy? Mr. Krause?
Crown.
Crown, yes, that's right. Well, that gives us almost 3 out of 3. Now, how about this one from Cora Harvard of Philadelphia? Arrange these birds in the usual order of their arrival in the area about New York City. Sapsucker. Don't look at me that way, Mr. Adams. Sapsucker, robin, crow, ruby-throated hummingbird. In the usual order of their arrival. Mr. Kieran.
Well, the crow is practically a resident, and the ones that move south come back very early.
In what order would they come back?
The crow would come back first. What are the other three?
Robin, sapsucker.
Robin would be next.
Yes.
Sapsucker third, and the ruby-throated hummingbird the last.
Why do they call that sapsucker a sapsucker, Mr. Kieran?
Because he bores into the tree and taps the sap, but he eats insects in there rather than the sucking the sap.
Oh, harmless reply. Thank you very much. Exactly right.
You, when you say the crow, you mean Corvus Americanus?
No, Corvus Bracorhynchus.
Well, back to English now, ladies and gentlemen. And now Mr. Cross asks Mr. Speed Riggs, the tobacco auctioneer, a question every smoker will be interested in.
Well, the question, Mr. Riggs, is simply this. What does a tobacco expert bear in mind in choosing a cigarette?
Well, Mr. Cross, most of us just think of one thing. We pick a cigarette we know is made of fine tobacco.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you want a milder, better-tasting smoke, you might take a tip from the experts and choose a cigarette you know is made of fine tobacco. For in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And independent experts at market after market see Lucky Strike pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting leaf. For example, this season at auctions in Rocky Mount, Virginia, the American Tobacco Company paid 28% above the market average published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Timmonsville, South Carolina, 36% more. And so on at market after market. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. Smokers, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. That's why, with independent experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. That preference is a matter of record. So next time you buy cigarettes, ask for Lucky's and see if you don't agree with the experts.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out two $50 defense bonds and two sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Russell Krause. Thank you, Mr. Paul Gallico, for helping out at Lucky Strike's party tonight. Now, next week, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran will pop up as usual, and our guests will be Deans Taylor, the composer and commentator, and the inimitable Alexander Wolcott, author, raconteur, and critic. Now remember, for every question that's answered correctly, the sender gets $10 in defense.